Today at Reader's Corner, Morvan Lalouette, co-author of Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to a special edition of Reader's Corner. A few months ago, I found a book about the Russian dissident, Alexei Navalny. Entitled Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future, it has been hailed by Russia experts, including former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, as the first comprehensive account of Russia's most important opposition leader. It was released before President Putin of Russia invaded Ukraine, but it is even more valuable in helping us gain a better understanding of the roots of Putin's power and whether there are any limits to his actions in Russian government or on the streets of Russia. Today, I'm joined by Morvan Lalouette, a PhD candidate at the University of Kent, researching Navalny and the Russian opposition. His two co-authors could not be with us today, but they are Ben Noble, a lecturer in Russian politics at the University College London, and Jan Matti Dolbaum, a postdoctoral researcher at Bremen University in Germany, specializing in activism and civil society in Russia. Morvan Lalouette, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much, Bob, for inviting me to your program.
Why don't we begin by your giving us just a thumbnail sketch of who is Navalny? Where did he come from? Please share with us who this man is.
It's quite difficult to sum up who Alexei Navalny is in a few words. He is Russian, of course. Your listeners will know that. He was born in 1976. So he was young when the Soviet Union fell apart. He studied law and finance, had a short-lived business career, and then entered politics. And across almost 20 years in politics, he became the most influential leader of the Russian opposition to Vladimir Putin's regime. And he did this, and this is to introduce already to the structure of the book, by being three different things at the same time: an anti-corruption activist, a politician in the traditional meaning of that term, and a protester.
And if you could, let's talk a little bit about how the world came to know Navalny. I think it's fair to say that while Navalny might have been known to Russia experts over the years, the poisoning of Navalny by Putin's men really put him on the front page across the globe. And I don't think there's anybody who at least reads the news wouldn't know what happened to him, how he almost died. He survived in a German hospital. Then he chose to return to Russia. And I guess that's where I'm going with this question. Back in the day when his predecessor dissidents of old Soviet system rebelled in one way or another, they often left the country, figuring they could do more good alive outside of Russia than imprisoned within it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn comes to mind as a guy who did just that. Navalny knew he was going to be arrested the minute he set foot in Russia. He did it anyway. Is there any way that the Russian people today can hear from Navalny? The last I think we heard from him is the day he was sentenced, when he spoke out against the invasion. But he's, in a sense, I guess the word is, taken himself out of circulation, it seems to me. Maybe you can comment on that.
Well, I think your question is kind of twofold. I think that's the first question, I think this question is on the mind of many people, is why did he choose to return to Russia, knowing, as you said, that there was probably 99.9% chances that he would be sent to jail. And I think that we could look at what he has said, and that is that he didn't leave Russia on his own. He was sent to Germany for treatment, as you said. And I think that's the first point. The second point, perhaps more deeply, of course, is that Navalny, by coming back to Russia, would show the true face of the authoritarian regime in Russia. Because before he was poisoned, he was allowed, in some measures, of course, coming across many difficulties, but he was allowed to have a political activity in Russia itself. And I think that by coming back after his poisoning, first he sets an inspiring example of heroism, and is something that is he has tried to do along his whole career, to show that people shouldn't be afraid. And on the other hand, he would show the true face of the regime, that is that he is dangerous, and that to silence him, Putin has to put him in jail. So I think that this is the main answer to that question. Now, of course, since Navalny is in jail, his ability to communicate with the Russian people has been drastically reduced. And so he's been able to communicate through his lawyers, who post his message on various social media platforms. Some people might have heard him when he was testifying at his own trial that is taking place right now as we speak. But of course, his ability to communicate with the Russian people has been reduced. And I think that this has been a serious blow to his movement, because however talented might the people around Navalny be, there has been never a doubt that he is the most charismatic figure in today's opposition to Vladimir Putin in Russia.
You know, you mentioned Navalny's access to the people of Russia. And one of the things that I found very interesting about your book was the fact that Navalny did have access to the people of Russia on the Russian internet, for example. And of course, I don't know, I think I'm like many of our listeners, we tend to think of China and Russia in the same authoritarian and autocratic terms. We tend to think that they're repressive regimes and that people really don't get the information they need. And yet at one point in your book, you point out that Navalny's blog, which of course was the opposition's point of view, was one of the most popular on the Russian internet. And my first reaction was, he got into the Russian internet? There's an accomplishment that I don't think you're going to get in China. I wonder if you could comment on just how much flexibility he had in those years. And is that changing now? Because it sure looks like Putin is doing everything he can to crack down on those protesters in the streets and online.
So when Navalny started his career as an anti-corruption activist, he used this blog. So this is something that took place in the mid-2000s, end of the 2000s. And this is the moment when Navalny started acquiring a kind of national profile among the opposition in Russia. And at the time, the Russian internet was incredibly unregulated. And on the one hand, on blog platforms like Journal, which was a very important platform for public debates in Russia, but also there was a very lively internet press at the time, and also a traditional press that, and across the years, we've seen how these spaces have been shrinking and shrinking, and it's clearly Russia today is not in the situation of the Chinese internet, but this is possibly the direction that the country is moving to. And so we have seen this when Navalny and his team was trying to promote strategic voting strategy that was delivered through an app that Russian authorities asked Google and Apple to take down this app from their online stores. And we're seeing that the repression of comments made on the internet is intensifying in the last years, and we can expect this repression to intensify in the next years, especially in the war context.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Although I did hear one commentator in the initial days of the invasion mentioned that people were getting some information from the Russian internet about the invasion, and I thought that in itself was interesting, that somebody was getting through to the people. By the way, while we're on the people, let me go to a quote of yours and your co-authors in the book. At one point, you say that in late 2020, 49% of Russians believing Navalny's poisoning was made up or carried out by Western secret services. Now, we in America are way familiar with the truth getting bogged down and not getting through to the people, and people just refusing to believe the truth. But I thought 49% was really a high number. Obviously, that's because, and you can comment on this, Russian TV is a tool of the regime, so they're not going to tell the real story, I suspect. But it's somewhat depressing for those of us who want to believe that somehow the truth will find its way to the Russian populace. And I mean the truth about the invasion, the truth about the war crimes that are being committed by Putin. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you that it is depressing. And I think it reflects what I was saying a few minutes before, that the television in Russia is under total control from the authorities. And even before the dramatic events that we've seen in the last few months and years, Navalny couldn't appear on national television in Russia. And on the other hand, it also reflects that this internet is getting less free and less free as we speak. And while you could see that in the end of the year 2000s, beginning of the 2010s, you had many popular news websites. One of them was called Lenta, for example, which was the biggest website in Russia at the time. And these independent outlets have been either taken into control or closed altogether. And so it's getting more and more difficult to access in today's Russia free information.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Morvan Lalouette. He is the co-author of Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. The book offers a close look at Alexei Navalny, from his pioneering anti-corruption investigation to his leadership of a political movement in Russia. So you and your co-authors quote two social scientists who say that power in Russia is co-constructed. Share with us what that means and how it gives us a clue of how protests on the streets of Russia today do cause concern for Putin and his oligarchs.
Well, there's many ways to interpret what these two social scientists have been saying with this short sentence. And I think that one of the most obvious way to interpret this is to say that Putin's rule has been based upon the consent of the Russian population, and it has been based upon delivering a certain number of goods to the population in terms of rising living standards, in terms of stability, in terms of decline of crime, etc., etc. And it has been based on the general population agreeing to these objectives and supporting Putin. And I think that we, all three co-authors, agree that there is an element of genuine popularity to Vladimir Putin's rule. And to get back to Navalny, I think that one of the most important points in his strategy, something that he acknowledged by the end of the year 2000s, is that Putin is genuinely popular, and that if you want to destabilize, to change the situation in Russia, you need to attack this popularity. And this is where Navalny's investigations on corruption, this is where his attempts to publicize his findings on blogs mostly, and then on YouTube come in. You need to convince Russians that Putin is a corrupt leader and that he is not bringing prosperity and rule of law and any good to Russia. And this is what Navalny has done over a 20 years career almost now, and that has made possibly set him aside from other liberal opponents who were quick to dismiss Putin's rule as only the result of repression and only the result of an unfree media environment, for example. Now, of course, we're seeing, as we speak, dramatic events in Ukraine, and it's very difficult to judge at this stage whether or not the war that is happening in Ukraine will have an effect, and what effect it will have on this support for Putin that remains genuine at this stage.
As a matter of fact, I noticed in your book, you get to the point where you're examining the relationship between Navalny and Russia's protesters. And to your point about what are we going to learn from what's going on right now in Russia, we can go back to an earlier time when a protester was pulled from the crowd of over 20,000 Russians who at the time, I think, were showing up to protest Navalny's arrest. That was like early 2011. And someone quoted him, and this protester said, "I'm no fan of Navalny's, but I'm a fan of the rule of law." And I guess I wonder if you could help us understand what appears to be a very complicated relationship with Navalny and the Russians. And right now, when some of us are concerned that Navalny has been silenced, and as you say, he can be talking through his lawyers, but that's not like having him out on the streets, so to speak. Maybe it's a good thing to know that the protest movement is more than Navalny. And I think that's what you and your co-authors were trying to tell us. Please comment.
So what we're trying to do is kind of counter this narrative that Navalny is a cultish leader that has created a tight and cult-like support in his movement. And working with one of our co-authors' research, we try to argue that actually, this is not the case. Of course, you will find people in Russia who have genuine admiration, genuine sympathy for Navalny's views and Navalny's personality. But you also find people who just happen to rally behind Navalny because they just think that he is the best around in the opposition and that he is, as we say at some point in the book, an alternative to Putin's rule, to the authoritarian regime, but an alternative without alternative. And this is something that Navalny has managed to do, and he has managed to establish himself as one of the leaders of the Russian opposition, maybe not somebody who is actually consensual in the sense that everybody would support him, but someone who is without a doubt, or was without a doubt, the most efficient in mobilizing people around consensual teams, whether that was the fight against corruption or falsification in elections. And of course, there is much more to the Russian protest movement than Navalny himself.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you about Yegor Zhukov, who is a more youthful protest leader. You address his work in the book, and I think one of your points is that his tactics may be different. Navalny seems to be more strategic and conservative than Zhukov. And I guess I have to ask, does anybody know where Zhukov is today? I mean, like this week during this invasion, is he picking up the baton that Navalny can't carry on the streets? Do we know that?
I don't know where Zhukov is, so I won't be able to answer that question. But what you mentioned, I think it's an interesting point that also shows how Russia has been evolving over time, which is something that we try to insist a lot upon on in this book, is that at some point, and Navalny was very conscious that he shouldn't call for protest action to go outside of what he made of the Russian constitution. That is, he would not advocate violence. He would, of course, break the law that concerns unauthorized rallies, because this law is completely flouted in the Russian context, but he would not call people to burn police cars or to storm the Kremlin. And this is something that was controversial at one point. I don't know if it's still quite salient today, because the other evolution that we point to in our book is that the landscape for protesters has been changing dramatically over the last 10 years. And what we have seen when Navalny returned from Russia in January 2021, and what we're seeing now when Russians are trying to protest against the current war in Ukraine, is that it's getting much, much more difficult to protest. And while even 5 or 10 years ago, the authorities would allow some demonstrations, now it's extremely rare that they would allow some demonstrations, and people will be arrested at demonstrations and possibly sentenced to very long terms of prison.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Morvan Lalouette, co-author of Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. And it wasn't always that way. You mentioned Dayton's Law, which I guess really was the crackdown years ago, two decades ago, let's say. The Kremlin didn't seem to care much about these protests, did they?
Well, the Russian people did enjoy some freedom of assembly, as I think you say in the US. Yeah. And I think that this is something that has changed over time, that has probably changed the most after the 2011 and 2012 wave of protests against Putin's returning to the presidency of Russia, against the falsification in the legislative elections that took place in 2011. And in these years, you saw massive demonstrations in many Russian cities. And you also saw in the aftermath of these protest movements, Navalny trying to use protest as one of his most important strategy to pressure the Russian authorities. And over time, the Russian state stepped up as repressive measures, and the Dadin Law was one of the turning points in the strategy. It's basically a three strikes and you're out law that says that if you violate three times the legislation on rallies and on demonstrations, which is something that is quite easy to happen if you attend a couple of demonstrations, then you can be sentenced to real prison terms. And this has had the effect of course, frightening many people into demonstrating. And for example, one of Navalny's coordinators in Siberia, when Navalny returned to Russia in January 2021, she went to two demonstrations. She was arrested and violated two times this law on demonstrations in Russia. And when a third demonstration was called, she had to announce on social media that she wouldn't go to the demonstration as much as she wanted to, because there was very, very high chances that she could then be sentenced to a real prison term. So this is, of course, something that is dampening the protest potential in Russia even today.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned his coordinator in Siberia, because another thing that I really never really thought about or understood was the fact that Navalny is not just a protester in Russia proper or in Moscow. Navalny has some kind of a statewide organization. Maybe you could comment on just how he has put this together. But I mean, there isn't much of the larger Russia that hasn't seen something of Navalny's organization, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Well, this is, I think, something that has distinguished many Russian liberal politicians from Navalny. And what makes Navalny quite distinctive is that he comes from Moscow. He lived in Moscow. Now, of course, he lives in prison. But he was never happy with just gathering a few thousand protesters in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, which is the second most important city in Russia. And you can see that he always had the ambition to spread his anti-corruption message, so of course on blog and on the internet, but to spread that message to the whole Russian population. And he wouldn't, adopt a disparaging attitude to other Russians outside of big cities or outside of the capital. And when in 2016 he started considering running in the 2018 presidential elections, he started to travel a lot across the country, organizing rallies and opening offices, which were called in Russian headquarters, to show possibly their militant potential in many Russian cities. And in doing so, he adopted a business-like approach with his number two at the time, Leonid Volkov, who adopted a quite business-like attitude, posting ads on the internet that they were willing to recruit coordinators for these offices across the country, looking at resumes and trying to find organizers that would be able to promote Navalny's message and at the time promote Navalny's candidacy in the presidential elections, which of course didn't happen in the end. But this is something that has made Navalny reach these levels of popularity outside of Moscow. And also, if I can stress this, outside of the internet, because there's always, when you read profiles of Navalny in the West and in Russia also, this insistence, which is completely warranted, that Navalny is a politician of the internet age. But what we try to show in the book is that Navalny is not only a politician of the internet age, he's also a traditional politician that will knock on doors, organize rallies, travel across the country, and try to build a constituency. And this is something that I think that made Navalny quite interesting as a political figure.
And you mentioned Volkov. I guess in American terms, we'd call Volkov his campaign manager, but he's clearly the chief strategist for Navalny. And I just wonder, do we have any idea what he would be doing like today in Russia? Is he taking over this organization? Is he in communication with these various folks? Is it likely that he's at least one of the reasons why we're seeing thousands upon thousands of protesters showing up and expressing their dismay of the Putin regime?
Leonid Volkov is currently residing in Lithuania, as far as I know, and he has been quite active in promoting the Navalny's organization, the Foundation Against Corruption, message in Russia. The foundation is continuing its day-to-day business. It's, of course, investigating corruption in Russia. It is releasing videos publicizing this corruption. They're also hosting live streams on YouTube and on other platforms. And yesterday evening, they released a video, short video, about 3-4 minutes, that was calling Russians to, of course, condemn the war that is happening today and calling for civil disobedience in Russia at the moment. Now, this video was released yesterday evening, and it's difficult, I think, at the moment to assess whether or not their action is having an impact on protesters, since from what we can understand, and I will not elaborate too much on this, but it seems that many of these protests are really spontaneous and are not really organized by any political force in Russia, even though, of course, some liberal parties are calling people to demonstrate and to oppose the war in Russia.
So the question toward the end of your book is the million-dollar one. Is Putin afraid of Alexei Navalny? Share with us your answer.
We believe that, yes, in a sense, he is afraid of Alexei Navalny. And of course, it's not by looking at the psychology of Vladimir Putin. We're not in Vladimir Putin's head. And if I may add, it's more and more complicated to know what is happening, not even in Vladimir Putin's head, of course, but around Vladimir Putin, the Kremlin. The sources to know what is happening there are quite limited. But what makes us say that Vladimir Putin possibly was afraid of Alexei Navalny is that you can see that the Kremlin is reacting to his tactics. And you can see that, for example, in 2013, when a election for the mayor of Moscow was organized, the Kremlin was willing to let Alexei Navalny participate in that elections because they hoped that he would be routed, that he would get a few percents because he was just a simple blogger that appealed only to Moscow hipsters. In the end, Alexei Navalny receives officially about 27% of the vote, and he is never allowed to participate in an election at all. You can also see, for example, that at some point there was some kind of liberalization of party registration in Russia. So many parties were allowed to register themselves as parties and participate in elections. Navalny's party tried to register, I think, more than 12 times, maybe 12 or 14 times, and was never allowed to participate, to become a proper party and to set a party list to participate in elections. So I think that if you look at a couple of examples like this, you you see that Navalny, contrary to other other political groups, was actively repressed and was prevented from participating in proper politics, which must show that the regime had concerns that it might score some victories.
Well, let's wrap this up, Morvan, with a thought about who Navalny's supporters really are. And this becomes critical for those of us watching intently, hoping and praying for some kind, I won't call it a revolt. That sounds ridiculous when you're talking about the Putin regime today anyway. Who knows what the future holds. But we really hope that there's a broad base of support from Russians that are willing to get out onto the streets, that are willing to demonstrate. And in your book, you talk about who these people are, that it's not just a rich kids movement, as you say at one point. Please expand on that.
Well, in this book, we used some research that one of the co-authors, Jan Batidolben, made on Navalny's movement. And his research tends to show that actually, it's not as the cliche would have it, and as you said, a rich kids movement, that it's also, of course, you can see that movement seems younger, but this is not high school students, as propaganda in Russia would have it. Now, of course, I think for reasons that are explainable and quite rational, you will see the demonstrations and the support for Navalny mostly in bigger cities, but it was interesting to see that when Navalny in 2017 and other occasions called for demonstration, you saw demonstrations and people willing to protest in much smaller cities and places than would be expected. And of course, what is probably the most important factors on whether you would be willing to support either Navalny or someone broadly like-minded, say, is whether or not you would get your information from the internet or from state-controlled television. And this, of course, gives a glimmer of hope that more people will have access to that kind of information, and that also as a new generation emerges in Russia, people will be more sympathetic to this kind of message. But on the other hand, of course, as we're seeing the freedoms of the internet being drastically reduced in Russia and repression being propped up quite dramatically, it also leaves room for quite a measure of pessimism.
Well, Morvan, I can't thank you enough for joining us today at Reader's Corner. I want to remind our listeners again that the name of the book is Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future, published by Oxford University Press. The authors, Jan Matti Dolbaum, Morvan Lalouette, and Ben Noble. Morvan, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you very much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.